The Guardian.
I'm Anoushka Astana. This is Politics Weekly.
Tough night. There has been some disappointments, but it hasn't been the wipeout in some areas that some of the polls were predicting.
The optimistic take from Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell. But these were a bad set of local election results for Labour and terrible for UKIP, whose councillors were wiped out even in one of the country's Brexit capitals of Lincolnshire. If this is a dry run for next month's general election, Theresa May is headed for a landslide. Plus, we hear from the Lib Dem Vince Cable hoping to make a parliamentary comeback, and from our own Angelique Chrysaphis in Paris as France gets ready to elect a new president. So a new dawn has broken, has it not? Well, not quite. As we record this, results are still coming in from local councils around the country, including several new metro mayors. But 20 years on from Labour's biggest ever election win, the party is picking up the pieces from another bruising encounter with the electorate. I'm joined first by Deborah Mattinson of Britain Thinks. Deborah, how bad is it?
Obviously, we don't know the full extent of it yet, but it looks pretty bad if you are a Labour supporter. It's pretty much as bad as it can get. Or, conversely, if you're a Conservative supporter, everything is going in your favour at the moment.
And when Theresa May stood on the at Electon, should I say, outside Downing Street and accused the EU of meddling in British affairs, was that all designed to feed into this election?
It was an incredibly calculated speech that was almost certainly something that had been focus grouped, I would suggest, with UKIP voters. And it was an absolute direct reach out to UKIP voters, and it was saying, you don't need to go anywhere other than here. You know, this is the enemy. I mean, there's perhaps a case also for saying they're looking at Labour and seeing that aspect of the enemy is so weak that they need to sort of define their battleground somewhere else. But yes, I think it was you could argue, very short-sighted, but it appears to have achieved its objective.
And what is going on if we say this is a very bad result for Labour? Is that because of Jeremy Corbyn, or is it about something that comes before him?
I mean, I think what we're seeing is a long-term systemic failure with Labour, where we've seen particularly the core vote, and those are some of the people that would be now have been attracted to UKIP in 2015, started thinking about abandoning Labour in 2010, went UKIP in 2015, and now will probably shift Tory. And that's a long-term, long-term trend where Labour has sort of lost its identity and its brand, and that's what comes very strongly through the focus groups. But there's no question that it has got catastrophically worse under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, where people have no sense anymore of the direction that the party is going in.
So inside the focus groups, what are you hearing? What sort of words are people saying about Labour, about the Conservative Party?
Well, one of the most striking things, I think, is, and it's very telling in its own right, is that we're hearing much more about the Conservative Party, or very specifically about Theresa May, than we are about Labour at all. And I think for a lot of swing voters, it's almost as if Labour is an irrelevance at the moment, and that's the problem. Whereas they're very focused on Theresa May and what she's saying, and particularly what she's saying about Brexit. And, you know, I think I've said this before, I mean, you know, the framing of the election as the Brexit election is effectively framing it as the leadership election. And, you know, she's very well placed as things stand to sort of capitalise on that. Whereas Jeremy Corbyn is simply not seen in the same light.
Why is she so popular? And is she much more popular than David Cameron, for example?
I wouldn't say she's popular in the sense of being likeable or thought of as charismatic, but she's seen as strong. And the feeling is that right now that's the kind of leadership that the country needs. So, you know, she's the right leader for the times. She's not popular in a more general sense and you know, arguably less popular perhaps than David Cameron was. But Jeremy Corbyn, of course, isn't popular either. People tend not to know very much about him. He's very recessive. And he's seen as just slightly sort of bumbling and out of his depth, and a little bit old-fashioned, not of the modern world. I remember somebody in a focus group once saying, he's the kind of person you could imagine wouldn't have a smartphone.
I wonder if he does have one now.
I'm told that he does, actually. But you know, it that symbolised how people felt about him.
And is there anything that they can do over the next few weeks to start to close that gap?
I think what they need to do, and obviously when the manifesto launches, there's an opportunity to do this, is to have a clear and very well-costed programme. They simply can't afford to have the kind of Diane Abbott moment again. Anybody that is out there speaking for Labour needs to absolutely be across the numbers and be able to reassure a public that will be concerned about the economy, concerned about Labour's ability to lead and manage. You know, they really need reassurance that Labour has thought through everything and costed everything properly.
That was Deborah Mattinson of Britain Thinks. Well, I'm joined now by Guardian columnist Martin Kettle and the Labour councillor Sam Tarry, who was the campaign director of Jeremy Corbyn's second leadership bid. Martin, it's an extraordinary result for Theresa May. What do you think's driving this renaissance for the Tories, if you'd like to call it that?
Well, I think it's a combination of things, of like everything else, but fundamentally, I think it's that the Tories present economic competence and a strong leader, and Labour doesn't, and so it's a one-horse race. And so the real question, you know, is how strongly is the Tory party going to do at the end of today in the local elections, and then probably in June in the general election.
Sam, you were campaign director on Jeremy Corbyn's second leadership bid. You obviously believed that people would see him as a strong leader. That doesn't appear to be the case today.
I think the thing for me is that clearly we're seeing now the culmination of some historical trends that go far beyond just what Jeremy and the sort of the surge of the kind of Corbynite wing of the Labour Party have kind of embodied. And I think for me, the really interesting thing is that the Tories are surging ahead. Labour's vote has not collapsed in anywhere as much as I thought it might do in some places, like, for example, in Wales, held on to some places there that if they had lost would have been clearly massively bad news. But instead, the Tory vote is accelerating and gathering in votes from lots of other parts of the electorate, and obviously, most crucially, the former UKIP voters. And I think for me, that really is the interesting question is, you know, the kind of hard Brexit, clear kind of delineating kind of line on that, you know, we're going for this almost, you know, sabre-rattling at any cost. And actually, I think the Labour Party, you know, we both saw this in the referendum and we've seen it ever since, is pulled in two different directions. It's metropolitan kind of heartlands, as you think, mostly all very pro-Remain. And people there wanting that kind of campaign and that position from the Labour Party. But in a vast majority of places where, you know, Labour MPs are in other heartlands, whether it's kind of, you know, say, sort of Dagenham, or whether it would be, you know, in kind of parts of Yorkshire and parts of the North East, a large proportion of Labour voters also voting for Brexit. And the thing for me is we haven't answered that question. How do you square that circle? And I think these elections at the moment are looking like we could be paying the price for that.
Martin, how do you square that circle?
Well, that's the great historical question facing everybody who describes themselves as being on the left across the whole world at the moment. I mean, therefore, there isn't a straightforward, easy, hand-me-down answer. But in the case of the Labour Party, I mean, the Labour Party historically has been an alliance. It's been a class alliance between progressive people on the in the middle classes, and the middle class is expanding in the UK and across the Western world at the moment, or in large parts of it, and the proletariat. I mean, Labour originally is a proletarian party, and that's what it was. But the ties between those two parts of the cultures of the party have become very, very badly frayed, and with the results that we've been seeing, I don't think anyone's absolutely got, you know, the magic answer to that. But the only answer, I think, for the Labour Party is to work out a way of working together and bringing both those interests plus other interests into play. If it pits one against the other, it's going to go on being doomed.
Mm. I would actually agree with that. I mean, it seems to me we've done some message testing on the second Corbyn leadership campaign. And one of the key messages I was pushing, and it was in a lot of Jeremy's speeches, was around the idea of restoring pride and dignity to left behind communities. And I think for me, you know, given that the Labour Party's position is we've got Brexit, but we're going to kind of give you a better deal on Brexit, a people's Brexit, if you will, is to really kind of expand on that and say we are actually about restoring pride and dignity city, not just kind of short-term regeneration projects, but long-term strategic investment, but actually explaining that in a way that means something to people. So high-skilled jobs that pay better wages in parts of the country that haven't seen that kind of investment in a long time.
But why hasn't that message been coming from Jeremy Corbyn? I mean, if that is what you think needed to be done and you were convinced he was the man who could do it, where has he gone wrong since he won that second election?
I think they have actually put forward a pretty serious investment programme. I mean, if a £500 billion National Investment Bank actually talking for the first time about long-term strategic investment into manufacturing. You know, I come from a community where when we lost manufacturing, it led to all sorts of other issues, including the rise of the BNP. And that's a similar kind of pattern in lots of parts of the country. And I think if you're able to do that and to really get people to believe that you will actually deliver them in a real and sort of tangible way, at the same time, without sort of making those same people feel that we're a kind of liberal metropolitan elite demonising people for being racist because they're worried about immigration, if we can do that, and that means actually maybe having some difficult conversations with the kind of more liberal wing of our party, I think you can get a combination that says actually, for example, in my view, I think, you know, the position that Keir Starmer's outlined, where we're almost now looking at accepting that we're not going to have freedom of movement in the way that we had it before, but perhaps actually we'll have a more flexible refugee policy, seems to me to be an example of how you can meld those two things together.
Okay, and Martin, there's been some interesting action on social media between people from different parts of the Labour Party and the movement on the left. For example, John Landsman, who, key figure supporting Jeremy Corbyn, says what happened yesterday was a collapse of UKIP to the Tories because they've become so right-wing. Labour's share is up in links and elsewhere, to which Phil Collins, who worked closely with Tony Blair, replied, wretched, embarrassing, get a backbone and admit you can't do this. It doesn't feel like the unifying message that you're hoping to see.
Well, I didn't say I thought it was going to happen. I think it's the only way forward. I think, you know, whereas when we're talking about the collapse of the UKIP vote to the Tories, I think it's really quite important to recognise that a very significant part of the UKIP vote came from Labour originally. And so the idea that somehow the Tory UKIP voters have gone back to the Tories, but somehow that the others are still out there, is probably not true, because in fact, it's UKIP has been a door through which Labour voters have been moving to the Tories.
On that point, I think we do need to be completely honest, and I think, you know, it's frustrating for someone like me that spent like 10, 15 years of my life campaigning in those kind of communities like Stoke, like the sort of estates on the outside of Leicester, where, you know, the far right and populist right have done well, and seeing the kind of ruins. I guess my pitch over the summer last year is that I thought actually you can have a sort of populist, pragmatic cause which actually people in those sorts of communities will turn to. The danger is at the moment, obviously, May has just kind of swept that all into this kind of like, we're going to go for Brexit at any cost, you know, we're going to reconquer Gibraltar, we're going to kind of, you know, get stuck into the EU. Every day it's almost kind of ridiculous posturing. But the problem is, it is gathering those kind of like forces. And as Martin says, we cannot ignore the fact that people did shift to UKIP in large numbers. And at the last general election, most of those people either shifted back to the Tories if they'd come from the Tories, but those that were from Labour stayed with Labour. Some of those, in a decent enough proportion to endanger a lot of seats now, are shifting those sort of Labour to UKIP, but now are going UKIP to Tory. And we have to recognise that fact. And that is a historic problem that started under New Labour and has continued and been exacerbated by the Brexit referendum.
On that, Martin, Tony Blair had a very open door policy on immigration. It is quite a long time ago now. It was 2004. Is that still causing a lot of the problems for the left? And you talk about this coalition. Maybe the coalition that exists now is actually one between right-wing, socially conservative views among the working classes and the Conservative Party.
Well, that could be true. And I mean, the Tory, let's pay the Tory the compliment of recognising that they are trying to do that. That is what they are trying to achieve. And, you know, May, in her own way, has a strategy which is aimed both at centre-ground voters, traditional swing voters, and at voters who have gone over to UKIP and perhaps even further to the right. So, I mean, she does have a coherent strategy. You may disagree with it, but it's a big strategy. The problem for Labour, it seems to me, is that It isn't inquisitive about the kind of society that we have become or are becoming. It's only offering really quite old-fashioned labour nostrums to deal with a society which is, 50 years down the track from when those answers were really plausible and were treated as being plausible in the mouths of ordinary labour leaders. And that's just not the case now. Jeremy Corbyn doesn't get that message across, except to the 20% or so of the country that always believed that in the first place.
Sam, on that point?
Yeah, I don't really agree with that, actually, in that I don't think that, I think it's a very weak caricature to say that Labour are just sort of presenting these 1970s solutions to everything. I think the conversations that were going on in the Labour Party about automation, the future of work, about how we actually could have a modern version of collective bargaining, I mean, these are all things which are, in my view, very kind of future-looking, and actually about how do we deal with the fact that the type of economy we've had for a long time and the type of economy we had under the Labour Party in government delivered for a while but didn't deliver in the long term. It was very fragile. And when it came crashing down in 2008, we weren't quick enough off the mark to say, actually, what we need to do if we are a social democratic party is to fundamentally redesign the economy in the interests of the majority of people. And actually, I think Corbyn has been trying to do that. But I think to say that the solutions we're putting forward are just kind of old-fashioned, I do think is wrong, because I think if we're not able to accept that the economy doesn't work for the majority of people, then we are saying it's fine that we're happy with stagnating wages. We're fine that, global corporations don't, pay their fair share of tax. We're fine that actually, the generation of people are never going to be able to afford to buy a home. We can build in aspiration, if you want to be New Labour about these sorts of things, to all of these kind of mechanisms. But I feel that Labour's actually started to have a serious conversation about what's the future economy looking like. Now, whether or not we can turn that into some sort of powerful sound bites, and I think there will be some good stuff in the manifesto, by the way, on that front, over the next 4 weeks, that is obviously the challenge.
Why do you think so many people think that Jeremy Corbyn comes across as incompetent, for example, on the economy?
I think because Jeremy's kind of like facing a situation where, he is such an outsider and he's never been able to kind of like puncture through it, seems to me, to kind of get a fair hearing. I mean, my view would be that if he can, and he should, go straight head-to-head with Theresa May and do that TV kind of debate, I think it would be very interesting. And Corbyn has got to actually just get out there, do what he's doing, which is, obviously going and seeing communities, being on the doorstep, being accessible. But I think the more he does of that, but at the same time, I would couple with that, putting forward some of our best Northern champions. We've got some excellent MPs in Yorkshire in the North. Get them out there talking about how Labour are really going to make a difference to people's lives and how the sort of Brexit that we're going to deliver actually will change their lives for the better and in a serious way.
Okay, just a couple of quick things. If it's a landslide Tory victory on June the 8th, would Jeremy have to go?
I think if it's a landslide victory, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for anybody to sort of say that we don't need to have a fundamental reassessment of what went wrong. I think the thing that I'll be saying is I actually don't think that a lot of the policies that Jeremy's put forward are actually unpopular. I think they actually are quite popular. There's a lot of polling that demonstrates that. I don't want to be in a situation, if things did go very badly, we sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think we also need to bear in mind that actually a direct transition, or lack of transition rather, after Ed Miliband sort of just literally resigned the same day, caused chaos in the Labour Party for weeks and weeks. If things were really...
You should hold on.
I haven't had that conversation with Ed.
Get to the conference, change the rules, make it easier for another person on the left to get onto the ballot.
Clearly that is what they're going to do. I don't think there's really much doubt about that. And I mean, one of the tragedies...
someone else could trigger an election.
Well, that is true. But I mean, I don't think Jeremy Corbyn's going to resign on the 9th of June if Labour's done terribly badly. And in a funny way, I actually think he's right not to do that, but for different reasons. I mean, I think he's not going to do that because so much of the project of some of the people around him is about control of the party. And the question is, who comes after Corbyn? And that is the supreme question. I don't think they're going to walk away and say, oh, we've got it wrong. You guys can have a go, because it's not going to work like that.
And just finally, the Lib Dems. Doesn't seem to be working.
No, the Lib Dems are... I mean, the Lib Dems are in a bit better position than they were 2 years ago. And for them, it's very helpful that there is an early election because they can get into double figures rather than single figures, probably. But they're not going to be back as an all-singing, all-dancing force in British politics in the next Parliament. But they will be a bit stronger and they'll pick up some seats, then they'll lose one or two seats. But it's hard going for them, hard yards. I think basically they're quite clever to have stumbled upon being the the Remain party, and that's going to see them through to maybe 20 seats if they're lucky.
Sam, some people are saying the only hope now is Progressive Alliance. Should Labour be talking much more to the Lib Dems, to other parties?
Look, I've got a long-standing position in favour of ripping up and changing the electoral system and putting one in place that actually, you know, everyone's vote really matters. And I think, you know, I'm always on the record saying that. I think the Progressive Alliance is more difficult. You know, I come from a trade union that has a very strong position against that. That is often a position, I think, also on PR for a lot of the trade union movement. My personal view is that I think on a case-by-case basis, I think it's actually the way forward. I think that the fact that on the Isle of Wight, the Greens have performed particularly well. What is the point of standing there, it seems to me, when we could actually let them knock out a Tory? I think the fact they stood down in Brighton Kemp Town, you know, means that that seat is now potentially winnable for Labour, maybe the only place in the sort of southeast where we could actually make a gain on current polling. And I think in a few other places across the country, you know, Clive Lewis' seat, and he's obviously on record saying this as well, but that's not the position of the Labour Party. And I think that the Labour Party as an institution, both on the left and the right, is not at this moment in that place.
I think we're nowhere near that at the moment. I mean, The Guardian's been in favour of Lib-Lab cooperation for more than 100 years, and I don't think there's a great deal of that going on around the country now, and any more than there ever was. If you're looking for tactical voting in this election, the most interesting example of it will be anti-SNP tactical voting in some parts of Scotland, where I suspect Lib Dems and even Labour people might be going to be voting Tory in order to keep out the SNP.
Sam and Martin, thanks for joining us. Well, one Lib Dem leading the charge for those metropolitan Remain voters is a certain Vince Cable. Our reporter Jess Elgott has been out and about in his constituency of Twickenham.
So I'm just about to go in and see Vince Cable, and I've been for a walk along the road down from the station towards the famous rugby ground, and it definitely feels like Lib Dem country around this part of the constituency. There are Lib Dem signs in the windows. People feel and talk very enthusiastically about Vince.
I think he's very good.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's very courteous. Sounded very, and he was a good MP as well.
I've lived here for a long time. I've voted for Vince for a very long time. He's a very good local MP. His integrity is intact, I think, and was completely devastated when he lost in 2015. So I'm really pleased that he's coming back, and definitely be voting for him.
A lot of them say that the current MP, Tania Matthias, hasn't made much of a mark. I mean, although she has only been in the constituency for 2 years. But I think one of the things that people say about Vince is that they think that he shouldn't have left the Commons. They think that it was a bit of a shock for him to go. But the reality is obviously that the Conservatives have got such a massive national swing, and one guy told me that he thought that although Brexit was the thing the media was talking about, the main thing for a lot of people around here was the economy, and a lot of people would trust the Conservatives more on the economy than they would the Lib Dems.
I mean, essentially what she's wanting is a landslide so she can present it as a sign of strength and in negotiations and so on, and for her own personal political future and self-esteem, she wants a big majority. So and they're, you know, keeping rigidly on message. I mean that we all have our personal views about it, but at the end of the day, so far her opinion ratings are holding up pretty well. I mean, in a way, the Lib Dems are in a somewhat different position from Labour, because I think the more we see this coronation style of campaign, you know, preparing for massive majorities, I think what we are beginning to stir, certainly in areas like Twickenham, is an uncomfortable feeling that this is a kind of quasi one party state, mm. and that, you know, dissent is not welcome. To use the phrase of the Daily Mail, that saboteurs will be crushed. And a lot of people don't like that. And they do want, a variety of voices, and they want opposition and the belief that opposition is strong government. And, you know, I'm here, you know, my people are here to provide that.
What's the issue coming up on the doorstep the most? Is it Brexit?
Yes, it is coming up the most. But I'd suspect that over the next, well, it's now 5.5 weeks, that may erode. I mean, round here, there is a big issue bubbling up over school funding, which is extremely alarming, what's actually happening. You know, kids being put onto part-time, teachers being made redundant. And in a very education-conscious area like this, that is really terrible news, actually. There's this constant issues around social care and health. I mean, that's not news, but it's a kind of part of the undertow issues around the airport. And I think as the campaign goes on, those issues will sort of play in. But certainly, as of now, Brexit, seen from different standpoints, is the issue people want to talk about most.
Jessica Elgott there in Twickenham with Vince Cable. Well, you can follow all our political news and analysis on theguardian.com/politics. Now, one of the most unpredictable and divisive French presidential elections reaches its denouement on Sunday, as centrist Emmanuel Macron faces off against the far-right's Marine Le Pen. It's a race that, according to the polls at least, is not close. Macron has a 20-point lead as official campaigning comes to an end. Now let's talk to our own reporter, Angélique Chrysaphis, who is in Paris. Angélique, the French pollsters were incredibly accurate in the first round. So is there any reason to doubt that we'll be seeing President Macron?
I think that is the feeling in France here, but the question is what the score is. But I would just say that nothing is impossible here. For Marine Le Pen to win now, given the pollsters' predictions, she would need to gain about at least 6 million votes and she would need a huge amount of abstention. So while that's not impossible, most people are factoring in a Macron win. His team are being very circumspect, though, and they're not counting their chickens till they've hatched. But it's not just for him about winning, it's the score he gets. He needs to win by a landslide if he's going to be able to govern here.
Because he hasn't got any MPs?
Well, there's various things. He started a political movement less than a year ago. He's never run for parliament. And as president, he's merely a figurehead. He's merely there to sort of be almost like a monarchic figure if he doesn't win a majority in parliament and have a prime minister with him to change the law. He won't be able to do anything in terms of the reforms. And that would be the same for Marine Le Pen, by the way, if she won. So they would both of them would need a majority in parliament. We've got parliamentary elections coming up in June. So he is banking that this movement that has no political experience, has only just started a year ago, is going to be able to win a majority in the 577-seat House, which is massive. It's going to be very difficult. If he doesn't get a majority, we'll have to find some new way of coalition government, and that's also going to be tricky. So this second round has to be got out of the way on Sunday, but there's also a feeling that we're only just beginning now, that the parliamentaries in France are going to be so important this year.
And if there is any sense that he might not get that majority, which parties could you see him going into coalition with?
Well, this is the question here. I mean, the French political landscape was blown apart in the first round of the French presidential election. Both parties of government, the right and the left, were knocked out in the first round, bringing us through with Emmanuel Macron, who disguised himself as neither right or neither left. He doesn't even like being called a centrist. He finds that word very bland. This idea that I'm pragmatic, I will govern with everyone and anyone who wants to come onto my platform, which is economically pro-business, so economically liberal, but socially very left-wing. That gives him a bit of a leeway for people to jump ship to him from other parties, but he also wants to have in Parliament at least 50% of candidates who've never run as politicians before. He wants to renew the political class, and he wants to have women in there as well. Now, at the same time, France has been divided into four. You had roughly a quarter of the vote going to Macron, a quarter of the vote going to Le Pen, that's not going to go away, a quarter going to the hard left, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, and the last quarter for the right, François Fillon. He's got to somehow wade his way through a very divided country. And I'll just say as well that if he wins by 60-40%, 40% is huge for the far right. That's massive score for Marine Le Pen, about 11 million voters. That's also going to be a thorn in his side for the next 5 years if he was to win.
And if 40% of people in France do support the far right, what does that mean for society after this? I mean, what could President Macron, if that's who it is, do to try to, you know, mend those bridges?
That's really important. I mean, I think he's probably, you know, people are working away on speeches and actions that he can take in the first day of office if he wished to win, if he is to win, to give that message. It's very interesting politically. The FN, in terms of parliamentary elections, they've currently got two MPs in Parliament because they work very well when there's proportional representation. But of course, there isn't proportional representation in the French Parliament as it stands. So even if they hugely increase their seats, they might be looking at 15 seats at least to get their own parliamentary group. So they can't do that much damage to him in Parliament, but it's their ideas that are sort of permeating French society and have been for a while. And so they feel, especially if they get 40%, that they have somehow won the battle of ideas. And one of Macron's big areas is diversity, racism, and living together peacefully. And that is a very, you know, national identity in France. That's a very tense area of French politics at the moment. It'd be interesting to see what he plans to do on that.
And what would she do afterwards?
Oh, well, I mean, her policy proposals are very straight. Nothing's really changed in the party's history. France for the French. That means a national priority for French people over foreigners. She wants to halt all legal immigration immediately, call a moratorium on legal immigration, and then she wants to restrict it. She'd want to ban religious symbols like the headscarf from any public place. I mean, these are traditional fare of the far right that's been in her manifesto programme, not to mention the anti-European Union stance, which is so contrasted to Macron's pro-European stance.
So he is pro-European. Clearly, the rest of the EU will consider it to be a great victory for him. What are his views about Brexit?
Well, he's in the school of thought, which, you know, the political class in France here is and has been for a long time anyway, which is there's no such thing as a happy Brexit, because we've got to look out for this European Union, what we can do with it, how we can make it more relevant to people, and we've got to protect ourselves. So although he's, you know, he speaks English, he's hugely open looking on the world, he's already been to see Theresa May, he's not planning to fall out with Theresa May, I really don't think. But what he needs to do in his first trip, if he was to get elected, his first visit will be to Berlin with Angela Merkel. He wants to get the Franco-German axis working again. That's going to depend a lot on the reforms he does in France, by the way. He's not going to be able to swing into Europe and say, hey, I'm ruling the show, because France is in bad state economically and they need to sort themselves out. That's one thing he's already argued. But he's going to be there insisting that the interests of the European Union come first.
And final question, if Marine Le Pen were to win, would it mean Frexit?
Well, if she was to win, she what she has said is that she would have a referendum, an in-out referendum. And she's basically following the David Cameron plan, that she would try to go to Brussels and renegotiate, and then she would have an in-out referendum. I mean, this is all very complicated, because then you would have to look at who would win in a referendum, and if she won, how she would govern. We're talking about the same issues of parliamentary majority as well. But that's her thinking. But one thing that's been very interesting and will be very interesting in the final result is that she's clung to her idea that she wants France to leave the euro. That's a complicated issue here. And there's a lot of voters that are put off the FN, especially right-wing older pensioners, for example, who don't like this idea of walking out of the euro. So she's tried to temper it a bit in the last few days, and it's got very complicated and very convoluted and very bitter inside her party. So that Europe and the euro is something that's causing a lot of angst within the FN at the moment anyway. And that would be interesting to see how that plays out in the parliamentaries as well.
Angelique Chrysafis there. Well, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Angelique, Deborah Mattinson, Martin Kettle, Sam Tarry and Jess Elgert. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anoushka Astana. Thanks for listening.